1, 2, 3.
Welcome to In the Studio with a 21st Century Perspective on History's Greatest Rock Albums. I'm Redbeard, and today, in the studio, it's just some of the best as Bon Jovi's prayer is answered.
Shot through the heart, and you're to blame, darling, you give love a bad name.
Bang, you know, shot through the heart, and you're to blame. I mean, you give love a bad name. As soon as that needle hit that record in 1986, our lives changed. And we toured the world and we played with band. Here we are, a bunch of kids singing, "Oi, she's a little runaway." And we're playing in front of like Judas Priest and the Scorpions, and people are chucking things at us, you know what I mean? It was pretty insane. I mean, Tico had to wear like a Yankees batting helmet, you know, in places and stuff. It was nasty, but we learned a lot. Hi, this is John Bon Jovi of Bon Jovi.
Hi, this is Richie Sambora,
and you are in the studio.
Since starting out in earnest in the early 80s, living on a prayer of finding fame, fortune, and the rock respect of their many idols who came before them, as well as their peers who traveled parallel paths, Bon Jovi found that last goal particularly elusive until now. Celebrate their induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame with John Bon Jovi and former guitarist-songwriter Richie Sambora, focusing on their best of the 80s in the studio today. To attempt to get your head around the phenomenon of Bon Jovi's third album, Slippery When Wet, 3 decades ago, it helps to ride out the worldwide sales estimates since then. It's the number 28, followed by 6 zeros. That's 28 million copies. No hyperbole here. It's impossible to overstate how massively popular Bon Jovi's Slippery When Wet became for the rest of the 80s. But what does that do to the lives of the individuals involved? You'll find out today from namesake John Bon Jovi and original guitarist co-writer Richie Sambora, framed by these unforgettable songs. John Bon Jovi readily admits that the band's live performance savvy was still ahead of the songcraft, even after those first two albums.
I had to find subject matter that was going to move the audience as I most preferred to play for. Case in point, You Give Love a Bad Name versus Only Lonely on the second record. You know, I'd broken up with what is now my wife. I was, you know, in the misery and, you know, the teenage angst was now gone. I was in my young 20s, but the girl of my high school dreams had left me and blah, blah, blah. I really didn't have much to talk about, but what I did have to talk about hurt me deeply. We were writing quite a bit throughout the Fahrenheit tour and what was to lead up to the Slippery recording. There was no shortage of songs. That much I remember, that whole period of 86 right through New Jersey. And actually, come to think of it, every record, we write a lot of stuff. I was becoming very aware that I was able to move a stadium. I knew how to find the person in the back row and let them believe that I was looking right at them, which I was doing my best to make sure that I was, and contacting and having contact with them. So if it was the innocence of youth that made you write a song like, you know, something as simple as Raise Your Hand, at least there was interaction between me and that audience. And I knew how to work that thing. You know, it was just something that I was quite comfortable doing. Everybody finds their niche, and those who survive and those who make any kind of mark in our business find something that is definitively theirs. And there have been some great examples of, you know, Stevie Ray was always going to be Stevie Ray. You know, that you just knew every time you heard that Stratocaster that was Stevie. Or when Hendrix played, you just knew that was Hendrix playing a guitar. When you saw Bruce as a performer or Bono as a performer, you knew the kind of power that they had. I knew how to work that audience and work them up. And that probably came from a wide array of influences, but nonetheless, it was different than the genre of music I was participating in. So when you wrote those kind of songs and you added the big hook, it became our genre. It became our personal little niche.
On the street where you live, girls talk about their social lives. They're made of lipstick, plastic, and paint. Don't you see when they rise? All your past, when's your daddy gonna talk to you? But you were living in another world, trying to get a message through. No one heard a single word you said. They should have seen it in your eyes, what was going around your head. Oh, she's a little runaway. Daddy's girl and fast, all the things he couldn't say.
Songwriter Richie Sambora, who was in Bon Jovi until 2013, with me in the studio.
When did you find out that you could write with John and that the two of you collaborating seemed to be stronger than either one of you alone?
I don't think it was on the first two albums for me, but quite frankly, I didn't enjoy either one of those records personally. I was in a much more mature state in my career, I think, than that particular record, and I wasn't even sure if the band was going to survive. I mean, there's some bright spots, but I don't think we reached the soul of it. Probably not until Slippery When Wet. That's when I really thought that we probably hit it. John was a little bit closed. I think it took a couple of tours to see, that these guys were going to stick by him and stuff like that things like that. And, quite frankly, after 7800 Degrees Fahrenheit, I was saying, man, jeez, I wasn't happy with the records we were making. But a lot of other people were, and we toured them so diligently that it was old-time hockey. I think we shoved them down everybody's throat.
You know what? It was old-time hockey.
It was old-time hockey.
It really was.
That's really what it was. And we toured the world, and we played with band. Here we are, a bunch of kids singing, Oi, she's a little runaway.
And we're playing in front of like Judas Priest and the Scorpions, and people are chucking things at us. You know what I mean? It was pretty insane. I mean, Tico had to wear like a Yankees batting helmet, you know, in places and stuff. It was nasty, but we learned a lot, you know, and we became a real tight unit. But I think that, you know, I mean, John and I had a writing chemistry at that point, but I don't think we really wrote any great songs until Slippery, and that was really when it came through.
Shot through the heart, and you're to blame, darling. You give love a bad name.
Jon Bon Jovi if he borrowed the song title Shot Through the Heart from their first album for the chorus of a song that would become a big hit, he didn't hesitate to answer.
Yes. Yes.
Yep.
Yes. Yep.
You know, Steve Miller.
I did. I'm guilty.
Well, yes. Steve Miller said if you're going to steal, you might as well steal from yourself.
Yes, right. You know, isn't that the truth? Or the other great quote was, a good writer copies and a great writer steals. And I am certainly guilty in that instance of nicking one right from myself. But the line just needed to be there, no matter how hard I tried to work around it. You just said, God darn it, you got to go with that, you know. And and it's okay, because not as many people heard the first record as they did that third one. And bang, you know, a shot through the heart and you're to blame. I mean, you give love a bad name. As soon as that needle hit that that record in 1986, Our Lives Changed.
A vivid example of the cinematic nature which John Bon Jovi and Richie Sambora employed on several songs from Bon Jovi's 1986 third album, Slippery When Wet, is Wanted Dead or Alive.
All of 84 with the first record and all of 85 was spent living out of a suitcase on a bus, traveling anywhere with anyone who would have us play with them. If it wasn't on our own little club or theater shows, we were out opening for the Scorpions or Rat or for Kiss or for anybody who would take us. So I was on this bus in the middle of the country, a little out of my element, but nonetheless rolling down some endless highway. And I was up at dawn just staring out the window and trying to figure out why I wasn't feeling what I needed to be feeling, really, which was, I came from growing up listening to the Giles Band and listening to Southside Johnny. And, you know, it was a R&B regional, successful kind of localized music, if you will, that had nothing to do with what was becoming very popular out of Los Angeles or the bands that we were opening for. I had very little in common with any of them. I was up at dawn staring out this bus window, and the idea just hit me that, you know, it was going to be my road song. It was going to be Turn the Page. It was going to be that kind of this is my story now. And no matter what, they were just, you know, they're pushing you along, making you do something to go out there and get your name known, get a, build a reputation, son. You know, go and get your chops, go and pay your dues. And so, you know, I just sat there and strummed away. And the day that we sat down to write it, we were home. We were in the basement of Richie's mother's house in Woodbridge, New Jersey. And I woke Rich up, and you know, about 1 in the afternoon when the sun was warm, we'd get together and sit in that basement and knock one out before dinner. And that was one of those good days where we wrote that and another one. And it was done start to finish in an afternoon, because God knows that the emotion was there for it.
Cowboy on a steel horse I ride.
still a showstopper on the current tour. That's Bon Jovi from the 1986 breakthrough album Slippery When Wet. Coming back in the studio, John Bon Jovi and ex-member Richie Sambora will have widely differing memories of writing the international hit Living on a Prayer. For those and other favorite rock star interviews, visit inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio for Crossroads, the early best of Hall of Fame inductees Bon Jovi.
Hi, this is John Bon Jovi of Bon Jovi.
Hi, this is Richie Sambora in the studio.
Thanks, guys. I'm Redbeard. I asked Richie Sambora and John Bon Jovi, the co-authors of the song Living on a Prayer from the 1986 Slippery When Wet album, to recall composing the song. John goes first.
I could tell you that I didn't think much of it. It was so different than anything we had done before, and with the key change and what was to become the bass line, that when we wrote it, and I remember Richie wasn't feeling well, we wrote it in New York City.
Co-writer Richie Sambora's recollection of writing the song Living on a Prayer is vivid, vividly bad.
I got very, very drunk on Jack Daniels. and then I just remembered, I said, oh man, I'm expected in New York City tomorrow at like 10 a.m. over at Desmond's apartment to do this thing. And I sat down at the piano and I was very drunk. And I had that chord change that was, going from the C to the D and the E minor, and I just held a E note over it, and I just had this one word in my mind called prayer, that because I was, I didn't know what I was going to do. I wanted to show up with something with these guys. So anyway, I got there very late. There was an extreme amount of traffic. I was throwing up in a Lincoln tunnel, turning green. Then I couldn't find a parking place. I had to walk in the rain to the house, and they had already been starting something else, and I didn't look good. Let's face it, when I walked in. And they were writing something that I particularly just was, I just went, man, that's not happening. You know, this just wasn't happening. I said, look, I got one word, prayer. And then these chord changes. And
What did you play it for?
It was a piano, just a regular piano over in Desmond. He had this real songwriter loft kind of thing. It just kind of started there, and then we all jumped in. And at the end of the day, we had the first verse and B section and the chorus. And I just, man. John and I got in the cab after that, going back to my car from Desmond's, and I go, you know, John, this is going to be a big song. He goes, we're going to give it to some movie soundtrack. He just wasn't connected to it yet. And then when we finished it, he realized that it was going to be a big one for us. And of course, that was, I think it's probably one of the best songs that we've written as a band.
Track.
these two kids had given up everything to be in love and to pursue what they hoped was going to be a future together. And be it what may, you know, they were ready to commit. And at that age, and with the future that looked rather bright, that was very brave of them. I'm happy to say that, you know, though not all of the road was smooth, 26 years later since they've been married, they're still married. And have been married for 26 years, a long time.
Are you telling me that the characters in Living on a Prayer are based on real people?
Yeah. Their names were changed to protect the innocent. But, yeah, there was a young couple that I knew that was struggling because, you know, I guess I could tell the story now, and not that it's anything to be embarrassed by, but she got pregnant very early. They were both in school, and they had great aspirations to do other things in their lives. And, you know, he, especially his parents, you know, who struggled so hard to put him in this school, he had to walk away from all of it and go and get a job that it wasn't necessarily what he'd looked forward to doing with his life. And compromises were made. But I gave him such respect because of what they had, you know, set out to do and did, and have subsequently raised two very healthy and happy kids. And yeah, but they were the role models for what the characters became.
Do they realize?
Oh, sure.
That?
Trust me, they know. Yeah. Every year, whenever we're going to, and 20 tickets for, and I need 30 tickets for, okay.
Well, at least it's not the publishing.
No, it's not the publishing, but no, true. Yes, and I've given them credit for it many times.
After touring the world nonstop as a headliner for the first time throughout the remainder of 1986 and all of 1987, Bon Jovi recorded the New Jersey album. Then, without a break, they headed out on another world tour. John Bon Jovi bumped into U2 lead singer Bono, who was startled to see Bon Jovi in Ireland again.
In the fall of 88, I remember being in Dublin on the road with New Jersey. So a year later, not only had we written and recorded, but we were back on the road again. And in Ireland, in Dublin, and a wise man asked me such a deep question by simply saying, "What are you doing here?" And goodness gracious, I wish I was smart then as I am now, because God knows I should have got up and said, "You're right, I'm going home, I'm going to bed." But we did another 240 show tour, and that whole kind of, "I'll show you, I'll prove to the world, I'm going to write five more number one songs, I'm going to do," in retrospect, it was a big mistake. But that's what life was, you know, that's what we wanted to do, and that's how that chip on the shoulder came, and that's how, you know, we were going to differentiate ourselves from everyone else. This is how, but that was a trying time.
Where was that drive coming from? Was it internally? Were you driving yourself in the band, or was it externally for people that were prepared to eat the golden goose?
You know, when I at first, if you had asked me this question in 91, 92, I would have finger pointed. And I would have said, "Ugh, the ignorance of these morons who were just there to suck your blood and take your money." The truth of the matter is they were all actually quite good people who were just trying to do their job. But they weren't as experienced as they should have been to be in that fatherly, motherly, big brotherly kind of position. Because if I were a manager now, looking to a band who runs themselves into the ground, and regardless of people wanting that record or the agents wanting them to tour, or the demand of the promoters, I would be the guy that says, "Forget it. It'll come out when it's ready. It'll come out when they're ready. And until then, the world can wait." And you have to have had that confidence to tell the kids that you're working with, "The world can wait." Very few guys do that. Now, that took, you know, me as the, you know, 24 years later to be talking to you like that. But at the time, I didn't know better. And it was definitely me that was, had, you know, thrown his hand up in the air saying, "Ah, come on, give me the shot. I can deal with this. Let's go." Not knowing that I was just burning out one cell at a time and not enjoying it. And that's a shame. I mean, to be able to get to that pinnacle and not enjoy every last moment of it, oof, that's tough, because had it not ever happened again, that would have been a sin.
Lay your hands on me. 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 Lay your
from the fall 1988 album New Jersey. That's Lay Your Hands on Me. Next, startling revelations from Jon Bon Jovi about the pound of flesh and the for sale sign on your soul required by the Fame Game. For these and other musician interviews and exclusive live performances, visit inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with 2018 Hall of Fame inductees Bon Jovi.
Hi, this is Jon Bon Jovi of Bon Jovi.
Hi, this is Richie Sambora in the studio.
Thanks again, guys. I'm Redbeard. Each year at this time, we honor rock musicians ostensibly for their subjective artistic contributions to our culture, but also, to some degree, to their popularity. After all, it is called the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Celebrity from the entertainment business is a fickle and highly misunderstood byproduct of the pop arts in our Western culture, and few people outside of it understand the seduction or recognize the dark side of it. Here's someone who knows firsthand, Jon Bon Jovi with me in the studio.
What I didn't get out of that experience was the pure pleasure of it. And a lot of that had to do with a lot of good people trying to get me to do a job, but not having the foresight to see that these kids were going to get exhausted and burned out and not enjoy it. And if it's between a steroid shot or another drink or your parents looking to you as the parent or the people who are sucking up to you because of your notoriety or for your money, it changed everyone around us even more than it changed us. If you ask Richie or the guys, their experience will have been much different than mine. It isn't the most fond period of my career for me. It's one that I don't really look back on as fondly as you would imagine I do. Because I don't. I learned with time to enjoy it, and I learned to enjoy it on my own terms. And now I can say that I've mastered that. But looking back, I can't tell you that it was the fondest of memories, no.
Do you think Slippery Success changed the way rock and roll was made from there on? How do you think it changed the business?
At that time, I remember seeing somebody say they made, hard rock accessible to women and to the masses. And there's validity in that statement. It was Dee Snider who I saw say that. And he's right, because all of a sudden the guys who were going to see AC/DC and those guys or ZZ or, Scorpions and those kind of bands, suddenly they saw me on TV 20 years, ago, and you sing You Give Love a Bad Name to a girl and bang, zoom, the poster industry's got a big spike. There was a lot of influence in girls' bedrooms. There was pictures of us.
Yes, that's
true. And it was a number one single. And remember, there wasn't even a category in the Grammys for hard rock.
You're right.
You know, when an album called Slippery When Wet came out, that's when the category was created.
That's a good point.
It didn't exist before then. Being on the cover of Rolling Stone and having a number one, or a couple of number one singles on that record, it did make it much more friendly. It put it from being, a rock band that, unless you were a fan of that genre of music, you didn't know if I was from Canada or France or if it was my first then last name. You really had to read Circus magazine to find out who we were. But when Slippery came out, you could see, my name in Time magazine. And it most definitely had an impact.
Have you since made an album as good as or better than Slippery When Wet?
I think so. I think so. The thing that Slippery has on it was naivete and the exuberance of youth. And that's fabulous. I mean, there was nothing else in your life but making that record. There was no families. There was no money. There was no house. There was no anything other than making that record. And that is a beautiful thing. But I think that I've made better albums as a whole, because there's songs on that record that I wouldn't, think about playing live. But on the other hand, Wanted and Prayer and Bad Name and a couple of the others on there, I think, hold up very, very well. But every time you make an album, it's the best album you've ever done. Every time you release a track, you think it has a validity there that the last one didn't. Sure, Slippery was a phenomenon, and I'm proud to say it's mine. But I thought Have a Nice Day was, a better record. I thought that Bounce was a better record. But that's probably just because they're more recent.
I guess this time
Guitar-songwriter Richie Sambora, who was in Bon Jovi until 2013, with me in the studio.
To me, the foundation of any good record is a song. Foundation of our whole music business, anything that we do, is a song. And if somebody says to me, hey, Rich, you know, what do you think a good song is? I says, well, it's something that hits you in the heart, something that conjures up some kind of sentimental feeling, a sentimental snapshot of a time in your life, or maybe now, or something that you can say, hey, I felt like that. You know, pop music is very, very, very underestimated in today's society. Musicians and popular music is very underestimated. It's a very healing force. It accompanies you through your life, through the good times, the bad times. I mean, you remember what you were listening to when you were in the back seat with your girlfriend the first time. You remember when she broke your heart, what you went home and you put on. You know I used to go home and put on blues all the time when that happens, but at least I didn't feel alone. You know, so it really keeps people company. I think as a writer, I tend to write human songs. I tend to write stuff that I maybe went through in my life. There's a bunch of different ways that I can write music, from what's happening now in my life and how I feel. I have a very acute emotional memory, which means I can take, I'm very, very vulnerable to pulling out different feelings from my past. They're very clear. And my factual memory, due to the late 80s, ain't as good as I would like it to be. But my emotional memory is quite intact. So that tends me to, you know, to be able to write about different situations where I grew up and maybe someone broke my heart, or I can pull that stuff out pretty easily.
John and I compared the many favorable reviews from those first four albums. Since that time, it seems that critical response has sometimes been inversely proportional to Bon Jovi being one of the most popular bands in the world.
No one cared in the first two records. It was with the third one. And I think it took so many people by surprise that they couldn't be as cruel as they wanted to be, because it was just such a phenomenon. It wasn't until the fourth album, New Jersey, that I thought that the fingers were pointing at us. You know, I think it is people music. It's folk music. That, like that old commercial said, it's music for folks. It doesn't make it any better, but it certainly doesn't make it any worse than the most critically acclaimed, you know, band that there might be out there. And I'm a huge fan of a lot of those kinds of bands. But there's a place for all of it. And anyone who plays music, or anyone who's ever really listened to appreciate music, knows that the magic that music brings, I think it's such an influence on all the other art forms, be it painting or writing a book or a play or a screenplay, or, you know, I just really believe that it has influence on, obviously, dance and on theater as well. So music to me is the heartbeat of what makes people move emotionally. And I've been on the receiving and on the giving end of that.
This ain't a song for the broken hearted.
It's My Life comes from Bon Jovi's 2000 album Bounce. I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2018, all rights reserved. Transcription, Jane Carpenter, Brunei. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.